Before we formally begin, I'm going to do the obligatory cell phone announcement. So if you have a cell phone, please take it out at this time. Please ensure that it is on silent, vibrate, airplane mode, something that will not interrupt the proceedings. We really appreciate it. Do not put it away, however, because we are live tweeting this event, and we are tweeting at the hashtag LePageAtVU. So if you feel inspired to join the conversation in cyberspace or want to share insights from this conversation online with friends and colleagues who are not here, please do tweet. And you can tweet with the hashtag LePageAtVU. You can also tweet with the at LePage Center handle, which is our online identity. On behalf of Villanova University, the College of Arts and Sciences, and the History Department of Villanova, I am delighted to welcome you to the first event of our programming season for the academic year of 2019-2020. My name is Jason Steinhauer, and I am the director of the LePage Center for History in the Public Interest here at Villanova, which is a relatively new center created in 2016, opened its doors in 2017, and our mission is to bring history to bear on contemporary issues. And so that is what we do all year round, and some of the issues that we've examined in the past have been the issue of fake news in historical perspective. We've done stuff on endless war. Last year we did a full series of programs on democracy and histories of democracy and democratic participation. And for this year, our programming theme is revisionist history. So we'll talk about that over the course of six events and through the lens of various topics. And tonight's topic is, of course, revising early America. Before I go any further, I also want to make you aware that this evening's event is being filmed both by the university and by C-SPAN's American History TV. So this event will be on C-SPAN's video library in the coming weeks. We're not filming live, don't worry. But for the benefit of our C-SPAN viewers in the future, we're glad you're with us here at the LePage Center, and we hope that you'll stay in touch with us and learn more about our events moving forward. I thought I might begin this evening's conversation, and we do envision it being a conversation, both with our panelists here on stage, another panelist who will be joining us midway through the conversation, and with you in the audience. But I thought I might begin the conversation with an informal audience poll. So our theme for the year is revisionist history, and it struck me in thinking about this event that it might be worth getting a sense of what you all think revisionist history is. So I'm just curious, by a show of hands, when you hear the term revisionist history, who here thinks that that term has negative connotations? A few people, okay. Who believes that that term has positive connotations? Who believes that that term is meaningless and actually is completely irrelevant? A few people. Excellent. Well, it's interesting, right? Because our center's mission is to bring history to bear on contemporary issues. And so you might be asking yourself, is revisionist history a contemporary issue? Well, it's interesting because if you look in contemporary culture, you will find references to revisionist history in many places. So I thought I would share a couple of them to sort of set the table for our conversation. So a woman by the name of Kellyanne Conway, has anyone heard of her? She had a quote recently where she said that Mr. Comey has a revisionist view of history. So I would suggest that maybe in that sense she was using it with a negative connotation. Interestingly enough, too, a feminist blogger by the name of Diana E. Anderson recently, it's a little bit of a complicated story, but on the anniversary of 9/11, she tweeted out some examples of hate crimes that happened in the United States after 9/11. And she stated that, want to know why I tweeted what I did about hate crimes post 9/11? This is why. This is the revisionist history. And this that she was referring to was a talking head on CNN who had said that after 9/11, American society was totally unified. Totally unified, right? So what's interesting about this, I think, is that this term of revisionist history can sometimes be a shorthand, right, for a version of events that I don't like or I don't agree with. Or maybe a connotation that's, you know, I have the right version of the facts and someone else is revising it. I think it also sometimes can imply that the story is closed, right? The case is closed on a particular issue. We know with certainty what happened, and someone else is coming in and revising things. So what I'd like to suggest for our series this year, and I hope you'll be with us for all six of our events, is that we probe this question of what is revisionist history? Maybe we can even reclaim revisionism from its designation as a four-letter word in some circles. Because I think what we'd like to suggest is that history and historical scholarship, by its very nature, relies on revision. There are new sources from which we can mine historical data. There are new scholars who bring new ideas. There are new events. There are always new things that we can learn about the past. There are always new ways that we can think about the past and relate the past to our present. So I think we're going to grapple with some of these questions throughout this series. And throughout the series, you're going to meet scholars whose research and ideas have revised our understandings of some key moments, some key topics, and have offered some fresh perspectives and done interesting things to help us figure out what happened and why it matters for us today. So tonight, you're going to meet three of those scholars, and a fourth one who will be called up about midway through our program. I'll introduce them very briefly now. When you walked in on the screen, you hopefully saw their full bios and their headshots. Our custom here at the LePage Center is not to print out hundreds of paper programs that end up in the recycling bin and sort of go through reams of paper and lots of ink. So we invite you to use your phones, which are on silent, to Google and look up online more information about the esteemed scholars we have. They're really exceptional scholars and exceptional human beings as well. Immediately next to me is Ana Lucio Araujo. Is that right? Correct. And she is a professor of history at Howard University. She's also been involved with the UNESCO Slavery Project, which we'll talk more about. Karen Wolf, esteemed historian and scholar in her own right, who's also the executive director of the Omohundro Institute, and Phil Mead, who is the chief historian and leader of the curatorial department at the Museum of the American Revolution. So, Anna, I'd like to start with you. And how many of you are aware of this anniversary of the 1619, the 400th anniversary of 1619? So that's where we're going to start our conversation. Are people familiar with the New York Times project on 1619 that recently came out? Show of hands, right? So this has been a sort of interesting cultural moment, thinking about 1619, the 400th anniversary, this question about where does American history begin, who are its principal actors, how should we think about early American history? But I wanted to maybe start with you and actually, what do we know about what happened in 1619?
Then what we know about is indeed that 1619 is the year when it is the first documented arrival of enslaved Africans in the colony of Virginia. Then this is not the first Africans who arrived in the region that is present-day United States. We know that there were Africans, people of African descent living in Virginia in a census of 1619, just a few months before the arrival of this first documented group. We know then there were black people, then people of African descent living in Virginia. And in addition to that, we also know that 1526, we had enslaved Africans also who went to the region that is present-day South Carolina. We had later on, 1616, in the British colony then of Bermuda. Then we had these enslaved Africans who were then in these English colonies in the Caribbean as well. And of course, if we extend, can I say that if we expand what we understand as the United States, then there were Africans either enslaved and those who were not enslaved who arrived, for example, in the Americas much earlier than at least one century earlier, either in the region that is present-day Mexico, present-day Caribbean, and present-day Florida. Indeed, there were Africans who participated of the conquest of the what is present-day Latin America. Then we have the case that is well known of Juan Garrido, who came then with the Spanish and is a man who participated in the conquest of Mexico, then moved to the Caribbean until he also ended up in Florida. Then 1619 is a marker. It is a marker that we historians, we periodize, we select facts, we select sources as well. But in this selection, then we need these landmarks, and 1619 became a symbolic moment, but that allows us to commemorate in the present the presence of enslaved Africans and the birth of slavery then in North America. But indeed, the slavery and the Atlantic slave trade, they were going on for more than a century at that moment. And another element that I think that is important for us to have in mind is that the United States, that what became the United States already at that time, was not working in isolation of what was happening in the rest of the Atlantic world. Then these enslaved Africans who were brought to Virginia in 1619, they were they were captured then in West Central Africa in what was then we believe that they came from the region that is the Kingdom of Ndongo, that is in present day Angola, and they were embarked originally in a Portuguese slave ship. This is why then you are talking to a person who is of Brazilian descent. Then I come from Brazil originally, a country that was colonized by the Portuguese. And Brazil is the country that imported the largest number of enslaved Africans. This can seem exotic because Brazil, in theory, has nothing to do with the United States. But those first Africans that came to Virginia in 1619, they were originally transported by the Portuguese. Then that ship was attacked by an English, two English privateers then took the cargo. But these stories, they are all connected. And I think that this is what 1619 can tell us. It is the birth of US. History is the birth, perhaps, of the history of slavery in the United States. But this history is not happening in isolation and is not disconnected to what was going on in Africa, to what was going on in the Caribbean, in Brazil, and in Europe as well.
And I think one of the interesting revisions to our understanding of early America that has sort of been part of the historiography is this notion of the interconnectedness and sort of the vast expansiveness of the international slave trade, which is something that you are working on as part of this project. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how have historians been able to recreate and retrace the extent of the slave trade, and even if you have any numbers or statistics to share about how widespread this was.
Yeah, then what we know today, then historians, they have been, they made efforts to, in order to quantify how many people were embarked in West Africa, West Central Africa during the period of the Atlantic slave trade, from where they left, where they arrived, how many survived during the Middle Passage, how many died just after disembarking. Then I would say that one of the important achievements that historians, they did, and it's something that each one of you can access going to to the internet is what you call the Transatlantic Slave Trade Database. The address is slavevoyages.org, and this is part, then it's online, then you can have the numbers and all the voyages that are documented. There are estimates as well. And of course, that this experience that you are referring to in 1619 and this experience of enslavement and the legacies of that cannot be summarized to the to these numbers, but this kind, then the arrival of these enslaved Africans in 1619 is now documented also in the database that retraces the internal slave trade in the Americas. Then this is something that is accessible to all of us. We know that nearly 12 million enslaved Africans were embarked in Africa during the period of the Atlantic slave trade, and nearly 10.5 million effectively arrived alive then in the Americas. And we know that Brazil, for example, is the country that imported the largest number of enslaved Africans, nearly 5 million. The United States, indeed, this 5 million is more than 10 times the number of enslaved Africans who were brought to this country during the period of the Atlantic slave trade. Indeed, the majority of those who were brought to the Americas, they were brought to the Caribbean and Latin America and not to the United States. Then, of course, that when you are talking about the Slave Route Project of UNESCO and so on, this is a project that was born in the early 1990s, during that period that it was just the recent end of the Cold War, and it was part of it happened in the context of a commemoration exactly like this year is, 2019, because it was by 1992 when you had the anniversary then of the arrival of Columbus in the Americas, then 1492 and 1992, there was this need of perhaps start telling the history of the Atlantic slave trade. That's something that was crucial to construct what the Americas were. Then we have this need in the present then to choose these dates in order to be able to engage with this past, a past that sometimes we don't know very well, but whose legacies are very present, is still present. Then the way of coping with this past is sometimes to take the opportunity that these dates are there and then embrace them to tell a story perhaps that can help us to explain perhaps the inequalities that we still see in the present, and especially in this case, the racial inequalities. Then racism is something that is born with the Atlantic slave trade. Slavery is an institution that existed for many centuries in different societies, including the Native American societies in Africa as well. But racism, as we know today, is something that emerged with the Atlantic slave trade. Then the slavery existed, but those who were targeted were not necessarily people of African descent. And then I think that understanding that is very important for us.
Yeah, and real quick before I bring Karen into the conversation, I think too, part of what it gets revised with new scholarship is also the language, right? And so this language of slave versus enslaved, maybe you could quickly just touch on that and why historians have revised that language.
The issue of revising the language, of course, that is an issue of respect with people who are descendants of those who were the victims of these atrocities and who are still among us. Another element is also to not treat those who were victims of the Atlantic slave trade as mere objects or mere victims. People of African descent and enslaved Africans during all the period of the Atlantic slave trade, they resisted. They did wonderful things as well. And to use certain terms as a slave perhaps reduces these individuals to to this dimension of commodity. And then using certain terms such as enslaved can perhaps put more emphasis then on the process that led these people who were born free, like all of us, and who at some point of their lives ended up in a situation that they were caught prisoners of war and who were deported elsewhere. This said, of course, that just changing the language is not necessarily something that is enough. But I think that leads us to think about the past and think also about the present and the alternatives that these individuals they were able to construct during the period that they were alive.
Sure. Thank you, Karen. I wanted to bring you in the conversation next. Does anyone see the Philadelphia Inquirer over the weekend? By the way, in a special Sunday section where our panelists were featured. And part of Karen, your piece, which is a part of your scholarship, which I love, is I'm gonna ask you this question a bit flippantly, but do we have an East Coast bias when we think about early America? Are we leaving out a vast continent of experiences?
That's more than a softball, right? That's like a volleyball, right? You know, it's just, gosh, Jason, yes, we do. So could I start first by saying thank you so much. It's really great to be here, and it's really wonderful to be on this panel with this terrific group of people. And also, I want to say something about revisionist history, and then I will swing at that volleyball. So you know, I think the point about revisionism is that it is it's a recognition of how powerful history is and how powerfully it works in our lives all the time. That is literally when we decide to, you know, make a decision to go to the grocery store, we do that on the basis of our own historical experience that the grocery store will be there and it will likely have things that we want to purchase, right? It's also working on the biggest decisions we make about our lives and our futures. History is extraordinarily powerful, and how we narrate the past is very powerful. So when we don't like the way that someone has narrated the past, or we wish to narrate it differently, there's a contest, right? There's a conflict over that. And I think this idea of revisionism recognizes how powerful history is, and Anna clearly touched on that in a variety of her comments. One of our colleagues and the former president of the Organization of American Historians, and I gift this to you for your next five events, Ed Ayers likes to say that everybody loves revisionist medicine. And we do, right? And history, like medicine, actually evolves with information, perspective, with discovery. History isn't just sitting in a kitchen cabinet waiting for us to open that cabinet and see what's there. We actually bring methodologies and theories and new materials to bear on our analysis of what existed in the past. So anyway, it is true that absolutely when we think about early America, the strongest, longest dominant narrative of early America is an East Coast one. Most, I'm not going to say all of you were had exactly my experience as growing up in the United States, but many children growing up in the United States had this experience of learning about American history that began either in Virginia, if you're from Virginia, or in Massachusetts, if you're from New England. But in any case, a very powerful East Coast story. People here in the great Commonwealth of Pennsylvania like to talk about the importance of Philadelphia to the early American history. But I think the reason why we do that is because we focus very heavily on English colonization. And we focus on English colonization because it was the English colonies, not all the English colonies, right? Because Jamaica did not rebel and join the United States, but it's the English colonies in mainland North America that revolted and formed the United States. And to us, that seems like a kind of foundational American story, right? So we look to those English colonies and to that tradition of Anglo-American law and governance that framed the United States, and we see that as the key originating moment. And I think what Jason was getting at with this question about an East Coast bias is my argument, which is not my argument, it's the product of decades of intensive and excellent scholarship by historians all over the country and indeed around the world, to see that the American story is more than that beginning in English colonies. That if we think about what forms America now, it's not all rooted in a beginning in Jamestown or Plymouth or Philadelphia. In fact, people in North Dakota have an early American past also, and that counts too. And it's equally important that past in North Dakota or in Colorado or in Texas or New Mexico, California, Washington State. Those early American pasts are just as foundational. Now, that may seem counterintuitive because you think, well, what is it that happened in the Pacific Northwest in the 17th century that formed what happens with us today? How is it that we have a constitution, for example, that frames our experience of government? How does that relate to something that happened in, say, Washington State? What was happening there? But actually, those deep histories of Native Americans, of Native peoples, who were powerfully important across North America, who in fact dominated, of course, it's only logical. Native means Native, right? It's North America. It is Native territory. Native Americans, and of course the very important history of slavery, but also really powerfully across North America, that Native history that was really foundationally shaping how people experienced then what happened when Anglo-American traditions arrived, whenever those did arrive. So in California, those Anglo-American traditions don't really arrive until the mid-19th century and later. We think about places like Texas, which have Anglo-American traditions of law, but are laid over long-standing Native, then Spanish colonial traditions, then in fact an independent Republic of Texas, and so on and so on and so on. There are layers of historical past that are really important that in fact have enriched and created our nation. And I think what happens when we begin on the East Coast and we only incorporate places into the American story as the United States formally claims that territory, we miss the richness and diversity which has been at the foundation of the American story from the very beginning. So thanks for the volleyball.
I think you spiked it over the net. I think it's interesting, you've talked a lot about geography, but this also implies a different cast of characters as well. And so in particular, I know your work has focused on women. Yes. Your scholarship. Actually, women in Philadelphia, I believe.
Yes, that's true.
If we think about the early American past, the early American story as being formative, what role do some of these other groups play? And maybe is there something specific, concrete, that you could bring to the table for us to sort of change the way we think about that?
Well, let me try. It is true that my own research has focused on women in 18th century Anglo-America, and I've done a lot of work on women in Philadelphia. I spent a lot of time at Haverford in the Quaker collection there and the wonderfully rich materials. And I think that those women contributed really powerfully to the story of the American Revolution and beyond. But let's take that a little bit further and say, okay, so what about that broad geography I was talking about? What changes when we not only say, well, the American story is primarily, really, until the 19th century, a Native story? What does it mean to say that Native American women are incredibly powerfully important in the Native American story? Well, there are scholars who are doing wonderfully rich work to show how Native American women's tradition of diplomacy, their tradition as agriculturalists, shaped the Native societies that were in conflict and collaboration with one another, and in conflict and collaboration with European societies as they were, entering the North America and expanding. So I think there are ways in which we can think about women in every context, in every single demographic group, how important it is to think about the 52% of the population who probably had something to do with its development.
Well said. Phil, let's bring you in now. And who's been to the Museum of the American Revolution? Wow, great.
Great.
So I actually had the privilege to go maybe a couple months ago and was really struck. I'm going to change my... This one's giving me some problems. Let's not put feedback into this one. I was really struck by the exhibition that you guys have put together, the core exhibition, and in particular how the exhibition that you guys put together in 2017... probably would have looked very different in 1997 or 1987 or 1977. So I do want to get to that. But I then stumbled upon your thesis from Harvard and your work on soldiers during the American Revolution, and found that to be an interesting revision to understanding of the revolutionary period and the sort of the experience of being part of that generation. So I wanted to put you on the spot a little bit to talk about that. And maybe you could tell our audience a little bit about that thesis and what argument you put forth?
Wow, blast from the past. Sure. Well, I think my thesis, which was called Melancholy Landscapes, Writing, Warfare, and Revolutionary America, looked at 169 diarists, principally from the Continental Army, but from the Revolutionary Forces. I started the project looking for their politics, their political ideology, figuring that, well, they have made a commitment to the independence of the United States, or early in the war toward the English liberties that they, as they often put it. But I found that for the most part, they talked about roads and mud and houses and who gave them a barn to sleep in and whether there was a town clock, whether places smelled bad or good, whether people were attractive there, whether there was intermixing of people from different backgrounds, different racial identities, different ethnicities, whether there was a town center, whether there was slavery, how dominant slavery was, whether the enslaved people seemed to be dressed or not, whether they seemed to be hungry. principally, if there was a politics, they were trying to fit these complicated assessments of communities into some kind of rubric of whether or not having a town clock meant you were likely to be a revolutionary or a Tory. It generally worked, as you might imagine, in a self-fulfilling way where they would decide that, well, you know, I'm a gentleman, and so therefore other gentlemen are likely to have revolutionary ideas, and this town must have revolutionary ideas because it has a nice clock in it. And conversely, common ordinary soldiers who in the 18th century were both exempt from the codes of honor, so they didn't have to duel generally, they didn't have the obligations of their word in the same way as their officers, but also didn't generally have access to the claims of gentility. They found in that convergence of values, patriotic and landscape refinement, a claim in their own gentility. Well, if everywhere we go that has gentlemen and ladies is a revolutionary, then I'm a revolutionary, then I must be a gentleman, or a campfire, or a lady. And so they bring this attitude back with them to their home communities and find it causes great strife with their so-called betters. Particularly, you know, one, for example, there was one soldier who had served 5 years in the Continental Army named Elijah Fisher, kept a diary the whole time. He comes back home and he has a conflict with the man he's working for on a short-term labor basis, about 6 months, over whether he gets paid for his day of arrival or not. And he finally tells him, I have been around the world and in gentlemen's company and I know what handsome behavior is and you're not it. But one of the things that I found is that they were trying to create the country while describing it. There was an effort going on what a lot of historians previously had described as plagiarism among soldier diarists was in fact a common manuscript community on foot, traveling around trying to figure it out and share their thoughts. Sometimes they were trying to protect each other from accusations of misbehavior while out there. Most significantly, perhaps, the largest collection of diaries in one single campaign was probably the most ignored campaign in the Revolutionary War because it later came to violate or confront Americans with an unpleasant reality that the Revolution really did have to do in large measure with land acquisition the removal of Native people from their home territories, and that is the Sullivan-Clinton campaign. There are about 4,000 soldiers on that campaign and about 50 diaries surviving. And they were sharing their texts and creating a narrative that argued these people were, that there had much more elaborate homes and agricultural landscapes than they expected, and that was evidence that white loyalists had been among them building that stuff for them. Well, those people had had those elements of their societies for thousands of years in many cases. A British officer described General Sullivan's own account, which consolidated a lot of these, as the most ridiculous statement of demonic peregrination. Since Lord Mandeville's travels, which was a falsified account of travels in the early modern period, and his description of gambrel-roofed houses where we know only wigwams could be, he said was utterly a demonstration of his own self-aggrandizing. So, well, in fact, there's gabled houses there. It's just gambrel-roofed houses. It's just that they're in part of a conversation around the nation about what the country could be, and slavery. They go home with these ideas about regions that are in conflict with their notion of what America needs to be. So, a private soldier, Josiah Atkins of the 5th Connecticut Regiment from Waterbury, Connecticut, who died during the Yorktown campaign and compiled his diary as a sort of farewell letter to his distant wife, wrote when he reached Mount Vernon that Washington's enslaved people were largely naked. And he said, "What is this but that hypocrisy spoken of among the prophets, that the defender of liberty would be a keeper of slaves?" And this is from one of Washington's own enlisted soldiers. But one of the things that really reinforced for me is a couple of things, which I think dovetail with our conversation today and with both of your points. One is that the revolutionaries were themselves revisionists. They were creating a narrative of the American Revolution during the revolution itself. We all do this, as Karen points out, about grocery stores and everything. There are degrees of deliberateness and with which you might seek to record that and make that interpretation permanent or widespread in your community, which I think is part of why revisionism over the grocery store is a different political matter than historians writing or politicians using history, for example. The revolutionaries debated for their lifetimes about what the American Revolution was. One of the things we faced and one of the things we decided in creating the Museum of the American Revolution, which was the first real attempt and its outset, its inception, to create a national scale museum of the American Revolution, and we asked ourselves, why was that? Why had that not happened before? It seemed like such an obvious thing to do. The answer is partly because even the revolutionaries didn't agree on what the American Revolution was or when it happened. John Adams famously wrote to Niles' Weekly Register in 1818 saying, many people confused the war and the revolution. Well, the revolution was in the minds and hearts of the people. It was a change in their moral sentiments. And it was effected, he said, 15 years before the war commenced. The war commenced in 1775. Adams has the revolution being effected, so essentially completed, by 1760. Benjamin Rush of Philadelphia, a revolutionary and doctor, wrote in 1787, again, that it's often confusing to people conflate the Revolutionary War and the American Revolution. The American War, he said, is over. The American Revolution has just begun. It is only the first act in the great drama that has passed. It remains to change our government and our morals to sustain this radical experiment in political history, world history. So we have these two revolutionaries, one who thinks the revolution's basically over by 1760, and the other one doesn't think it's begun by 1787. They both lived through it. And why not? Because meanwhile, I think many people still in their time and ours would say the revolution was the war, which is the 8 years that neither of them think is really the revolution. So a couple of propositions we felt were important in developing the Museum of the American Revolution, which is in Old City, Philadelphia, and which opened on April 19th, 2017. So we do like our commemorative dates, which, anniversary of the beginning of the Revolutionary War in 1775, was that, number one, there were many revolutions in Revolutionary America, and we wanted to represent those. Not all of those revolutions were supportive of the legal creation of the United States. There were, the majority of Native people sided with the British. Many of them attempted to avoid siding with either side for as long as they could. But when pressed, the British seemed like the better bet for the guarantee of their sovereignty and for the hope to contain and reverse many of the transformations that had been underway since contact. And why not? Well, the British had provided, had established in 1763 a limiting settlement west, and the proclamation line wasn't effective, but at least it was a gesture. The Americans seemed to have no such scruples about that. The majority of enslaved people who are, I think we would agree, whatever their attitudes and ideologies and the roots of them, the challenge of finding those in the historical record is very difficult. But whatever they are, they're seeking their physical and personal freedom. And the majority of people of African descent who choose to an army to align themselves with, join the British forces, estimates of about 30,000, whereas about 5,000 joined the American forces. And I think that, and also that the revolution, nevertheless, it is important that the revolution created a nation in which the words of the Declaration of Independence were, those second paragraph's promise, were tied to the existential, the existence of the nation itself. The justification for the nation's existence is grounded in these very radical and strange ideas for the time, and that ramifies out, and it makes the revolution bigger than the period of either the war or the period that John Adams or Benjamin Rush described, but one that's ongoing.
Yeah, and I think that's very well reflected in the exhibition and the museum that you and your team have put together and should be commended for. I think there's a sort of a common theme, I think, amongst the three of you, which is this sort of history from below, the history of the common person, and sort of widening the scope of the early American story to include the common soldier at Yorktown, the women and Native Americans, the enslaved populations, to make sure that they are sort of edited and written into the story, as opposed to it being sort of a grand sort of sweeping narrative that only looks at a certain percentage of the population. And that's sort of reflective, I think, of where the history profession itself has sort of revised and evolved over the last generation and a half, would you say?
Yes. Yes, but I think it's not just historians. I mean, this is what we're all doing, right? I mean, I think more people, more communities are empowered to investigate the past. And the slavevoyages.org, in case you didn't get that when Anna said it. Yes, databases like that, which make primary sources available to all of us, so you can, you know, the kinds of work that people can do and can investigate. So it's not just, you know, we're not some... Well, we are a freakish kind of cult historians, but we're not so dissociated from the...
Which you are all now welcome to be a part of.
No, I think we are just of what's happening more widely, really. That this reflection, this sense that our nation's history is not the history of elites and it is not the history of grand institutions. It's a collective communal commitment, essentially.
and I would like to add also that, of course, that the work that we historians we do is not then disconnected from what ordinary people in different communities they have been pushed us to do. Then many of these discussions that we had before, for example, to create a museum that deals with this period of the American Revolution from a certain point of view, the creation of the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C., that also approaches the period of the American Revolution, the database in itself can be perceived as something that is very cold because it deals with enslaved people as poor numbers. But we had also then the community groups, social actors who have been claiming to be included in these histories, then the work, if the narrative provided by historians has changed over these last decades, is also the result of these public debates. For example, we refer to the special number of the New York Times on 1619. This was essentially then an initiative then by intellectuals, journalists, public intellectuals, but is not necessarily led by historians. Of course, that many of these journalists have been using the work, the works of historians, but then this is broader. And you also have then historians like us that we are engaging with the public, of course, in an initiative like this, in a museum, but we also do a lot now, for example, on social media. Then me and Karin, we are meeting for the first time in person here, but we know each other from social media for a while. And this, I think, that is a nice way also to engage with the community and to have these conversations that we would not have otherwise, because we would not have the means then to reach these wider audiences. Then I think that this is crucial for the work that we do, there is this need to engage with the public that perhaps was not that present, I would say, two decades ago.
And Phil, I really like this notion of create the country while describing it, and I think we're still doing that, right? And something we talked about last year a lot during our events on democracy was this notion of democracy being an unfinished project, a horizon that one strives for but never reaches. And in some ways, these questions about who is part of the American story, the early American story, how expansive is it? You know, does it extend beyond just the oceans that we call our borders? Does it include other places and other people? That is a part of that ongoing democratic project, to get all the voices in the table, get all the voices in the room, and create the country itself. Is that something that you feel is an accurate description?
Absolutely. I think that one of the unintended consequences of the revolutionaries revising their own story was they made it remote. They made it inaccessible, stony, marbleized, inhuman, heroic, or demonic, as the British commentator on Sullivan said. But not bloody, not fleshy, not life, not earthy, not doorways and fences and whether people let you into a barn. And I think that has made our history remote. And our history is a vital part of our civic welfare as a nation and as a world community, and a vital part of understanding how we make decisions and have made decisions, and how we might see eye to eye, debate, realize, have wisdom to see change and continuity. And I think the revolutionaries, particularly in their later years, for example, had unleashed something that they didn't anticipate in a lot of different ways, and they were trying to contain it a little by recasting the revolutionary past. And what we need to do is is some, in some ways pull the veneer that they found so useful in their time off in order to have a usable past in ours. And that actually doesn't, I think that's often understood to be iconoclastic, but I think it's impossible to expect everyone to invest in our shared story unless it's shared with everyone. And I think that's actually a key to, for lack of a better word, patriotic feeling.
And I think one thing that we need to put on the table, which all of you have looked at in your work, is that the early American story is one that is violent, and it includes bloodshed. It includes individuals who were killed or enslaved or who suffered. And I think that can make people uncomfortable to confront that and to talk about it and to equate that as being part of the American story. But I think you each have done in your own work some really important development of that. And I wanted to maybe start with Anna and then get to Karen and Phil as well on this, but because you actually cited this in particular in the Philadelphia Inquirer piece that ran on Sunday. And so how do we incorporate that into the story and sort of this creating the country while describing it?
Yeah, first of all, this history of violence, then violence marked then the creation of what we call the Americas at large. I don't think that violence is some kind of specific feature of the United States itself. Then all the countries that in the Americas were marked then by genocide of indigenous populations, then the extermination of these populations, violence against women, then the women who were raped during this process of conquest, colonization, then the forced migration of enslaved Africans, the arrival also later on and during the same period of indentured servants who were not enslaved, but in many cases had then living and working conditions that were also very difficult. And of course, that all these wars of independence, in some places we didn't have. In Brazil, for example, we didn't have a war of independence. But in the rest of Latin America and then in the United States, we had this bloodshed. And still, even with the independence, institutions such as slavery continue to be there, even if the Atlantic slave trade to the United States is abolished in 1808. After that, we know that there is illegal slave trade that continues to happen and an internal slave trade that is as brutal as the slave trade that included the Middle Passage. Then I think that this history, we are the product of this violence. I think that is important that we recognize that. Indeed, even to heal, even to be able to come to terms with this past, and also in order to be able to not perhaps construct a history that tends to glorify certain individuals, usually great men, then great men that usually great women are not included, then people of color are not included, and at the same time, all their flaws are usually then, I would say, then evacuated, not considered. And I think that all the initiatives that you are referring to, the work that is being done by you here in the center, Karen at the Alejandro Institute, also in the Museum of American Revolution, I think that, and the work that we do also at Howard University as a historically black university that is the product of all this history as well of slavery, I think that what we are trying to do is, in many ways, is to come to terms with this history that involves violence. And violence then is part of the experience of us as human beings in these attempts to live together. Live together that is an attempt that very often is hard to achieve. But I think that this is what we're trying to do. And as historians, by understanding this past, these difficult pasts, perhaps it can help us to deal with the problems that persist then in the present.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think early American history, with no disrespect to the other five things you're going to cover in this series, it's the most important, actually. And it's the most important for thinking about democracy and for thinking about what is powerfully shaping our experience now, our parents' experience, and our children and grandchildren's experience. Early America is the foundation. It is what we recur to. It is, can't think how many times you will have heard, I have heard people talk about, you know, our heritage as Americans, our early American past, our American principles, our American values. That notion of an early America that, as Phil said, gets kind of sealed off, and you think of it as this kind of glorious, shiny thing. We often talk about how the United States doesn't live up to its values. And I think, no, actually, when we see this fuller historical past, when we see this fuller, vast early America, we see that this was a struggle. It was violent, it was bloody, it was tough, it was gritty, it was frankly pretty smelly too, actually. I think we appreciate that democracy is something we struggle for every single day, and we have to struggle for every single day. It's not something that was handed to us. It is not just, you know, a gift that we get, that we, you know, kind of carefully tend and then pass on. It's something we struggle for. It's something we will have to keep struggling for. I said before, history is so powerful, and it is powerful because it tells us something about where we were and where we might be next. And these complex stories suggest that where we were was tough, and where we're headed might also be tough. I personally think we ought to embrace that, because I think it's more powerfully, it's more empowering, really, to think about that we just commit to that struggle rather than to pretend that it doesn't exist.
No, I think that's absolutely true. I think that, in my own editorial, I used the subjunctive when I talked about the way the revolutionary cause might have changed the world. That Thomas Paine said that we have it in our power to begin the world over again, and we still aspire to that. But it's not that we have declined, it's that it is still an aspiration, because it was never the egalitarian ideas that are layered into the revolution. One could argue how central they were, where they existed. Those were out of sync almost completely with lived experience in the time, and so having an understanding of that, I think, does a few things, and I think it shows how fragile this American democratic experiment is. A perspective on early America gives you a sense of how new it is, and therefore, in many ways, vulnerable, and. In a sense, if it were to end, one could think, what will people 500 years from now say about democracy? Every time people try it, the last couple hundred years, did in Rome, did in Florence, and here it does in America, let's not go there again. So the stakes are bigger than the American experience. And I think those are all things that come from an understanding of how violent and contingent early America was.
And I'm always struck by the sort of intellectual history that precedes the early American story, or happens simultaneously the American story of what's happening in Europe and how violent it was there. And a lot of the intellectual discussion is to try to figure out how to get people to stop killing each other, you know, essentially. The 30 Years' War, 100 Years' War, Huguenots being massacred by Catholics, all these things engender great intellectual debate about how do you create a society that is not one where religions are, you know, constantly fighting and murdering each other, and there's some sort of allegiance to a state, and there's some sort of sovereignty, and a lot of those ideas come into the founding generation and the ideas that they bring to the colonies and to the creation of the American country that we know. So it's again, broadening our perspective and understanding what happens before and simultaneous enriches the story. It doesn't deplete from it, I think. You'll notice that we have an empty chair on stage. And so at this juncture, I wanted to invite up Megan Keita. And one of the things we like to do at the LePage Center is bring in outside scholars and get them engaged in conversation, and then also have them engage in conversation with scholars here at Villanova. There's some amazing scholarship that's happening here at Villanova University in the College of Arts and Sciences and in the Department of History, examining many of these questions. And so we thought we'd take the opportunity with this series to put a little bit of a spotlight on some of the Villanova faculty and scholarship by having our scholars give a very brief response to sort of the conversation that we've been having, things that they're hearing, things that we've left out, connections that we haven't made, and then to invite that scholar to then join us for the rest of the conversation and engage with you, the audience, as we move to Q&A. So I'd like to invite Megan to the stage here to offer brief thought, and I'll introduce him as he takes his seat. Megan Keita is Professor of History and Global Interdisciplinary Studies and the founding director of both the Institute for Global Interdisciplinary Studies and the Africana Studies Program at Villanova. He is also the former director of the university's Center for Arab and Islamic Studies and its program of graduate studies in world history. His areas of specialization are African, African American, and world histories and historiography, and issues in class, race, and gender. So, Dr. Keita.
Wow.
Does that sound like you?
So first of all, I want to thank my colleagues. Maybe I shouldn't thank you guys, though, because this is a hard act to follow. It's almost impossible to do justice in summarizing it. So what I want to do is I want to point out one of the things or a couple of the things that interests me most in terms of this kind of work. Some of my colleagues may question the fact of whether or not I'm a historian. I tend to labor most of the time in historiography. I'm interested in the question that Karen posed very pointedly in terms of thinking about the power of history. And so as a historiographer, I'm interested in the why and how of doing this work. That comes back to Jason's introduction. The introduction lends itself to the question of the purposes of history. And we need to be clear in terms of understanding the power that's inherent in history is that history, no matter what you think of it, is purposeful. It serves interest. It is an interpretive art. And as such, it is subject to this question of revision. So I'm going to ask you to do something as the audience that my wife often has me do. And that is to think about the very nature of language here, the question of doing revisionist history. The root of the word is vision. The prefix suggests that we revision what we are doing. It also goes back to Karen's last comment about this notion that history is not simply about the past. It is not solely about reflecting on our present state. It also has something to do with projecting the possibilities of the future. And we need to look at that. The thing I want to engage just very briefly here in terms of the discussion that we've just been through, and also in ways of thinking about this very, I suppose we can think of it as powerful piece of work that the New York Times has produced, certainly prolific, almost ubiquitous, but as a historiographer, subject to question. And so the question that I have goes back to something that all of the panelists have mentioned here. And it's the question of symbolism in historical production. Well, symbols are things like dates, 1619. Why is 1619 so important? Some people are arguing, and some people argue on the other side, that this moment of 1619, this has been one of the attacks from many of the columnists in the Times, is the moment when slavery is introduced into English-speaking America? Well, some people say no. That notion there suggests that slavery is something that is inherent to a certain population, that it would be expected that once they stepped off the ship or anything that they stepped off of, that this would be their status. We know by reading the accounts in places like Virginia that this is a process. It is not, as one author put it, a kind of unthinking mistake. It was contentious. And the historical documentation tells us this. The dispute over the inherent nature of slavery, over the symbolism of 1619, and the question of enslavement as an American proposition, is also rooted in the fact that there are people, as Anna has mentioned, who were in Virginia before 1619 who were of African descent. And the documentation up through the mid part of the 17th century gives us no indication of what their status is, other than to move to another symbol that encompasses enslavement that we would call bondsmanship. And this gives us an interesting proposition for revisioning the American sense of unity. It could be argued that in colonial Virginia in 1619, more people were bonded than they were free. This bondsman notion would have encompassed apprentices, indentures, and slaves. Their statuses, if we read the statutes with nuance, suggest that those elements sometimes overlapped. And they overlap to the degree that we have to have legal codes that, in fact, attempt to separate several populations. So one of the issues that unites America at the very beginning is that most of us who come at the very beginning are in some form of unfree labor relationship. That's a symbol that we don't explore. We're fond of thinking in this way, and this was my metaphor for beginning my piece in the Inquirer. You all know Thanksgiving dinner, right? You all know 1620. You know Plymouth Rock. You know the Pilgrims. We go back to this notion of violence, all right? Well, we need to evaluate the Pilgrims in terms of violence on both sides of the Atlantic. We need to understand the questions of Puritanism. We need to understand questions of religious fundamentalism and how it plays out in all kinds of spaces before, in fact, we embrace a symbol of a kind of purity that's illuminated in cities on hills. Those symbols, cities on hills, bright shining exemplars, all right? Examples of chosen people need to be, in fact, juxtaposed with other kinds of symbols that talk about the very nature of the coming of the American state. So that would be issues such as thinking about, well, Thanksgiving, thinking about the White House, you've all seen pictures of it, thinking about the Capitol, and thinking about the things that were literally, again, to use the term, inherent in their construction, either conceptually or physically. That forces us to come to grips with the project of democracy, because it says that when we come to grips with the other revisioning of the symbols of who we are as Americans, we might be forced to work through some of the issues that we have there. So again, I want to thank our colleagues here and thank you in the audience for participating tonight.
And thank you, Magan, for taking on this role and joining the conversation. And I think the allusion to the audience is a great way for us to segue into conversation with the audience. We have about 20, 25 minutes left for that. Our typical style of doing the Q&A is to sort of start on one side of the room and then sort of work across the room back to the other side and then come back around this way. And we also like to make sure that we get a diversity of voices included in the conversation, students, community members, faculty, and staff. And we do have James somewhere. James, our undergraduate fellow at the LePage Center this year, with a microphone. So we'll start on this side of the room this time, and we'll work our way across. I'll call on people as we go. And just a polite reminder to keep the question or comment on the briefer side so we can ensure that we get as many people into the conversation as possible. And feel free to address your question or comment to an individual panelist or to the group as a whole to respond. So why don't we start over here and see if anyone on this side of the room has something that he or she wants to contribute to the conversation. And if you have questions as well, you can raise your hand and we'll get to people one at a time. There's a question down here in the corner. And if you don't mind, if you feel up for it, you can introduce yourself as well.
I've noticed in a few contexts how the narrative around slavery has changed in terms of more of a conscious whether it's in New York or whether it's in historic locations in Virginia, not allowing the whitewashing of the issue. How would you, knowing what you know in your body of work, how would you contextualize our current narratives, how we view Iran, different narratives that are going on in our politics speak? How would you?
I can't hear you.
Is the microphone on, sir? Can you check? Okay.
So I don't know if you understood that, but
I'll repeat the question.
How does that affect your approach to how we should be viewing our current narratives?
Sure. So I'll repeat the question for those who weren't able to hear it. Essentially, current political debates that we're having, how does that affect how we think about slavery? How do we incorporate questions about current events and current political moments into these historical examinations that are essential to our scholarship? I guess we'll put you on the spot first, Anna. I mean, thinking about current political debates, does thinking about current political debates impact your scholarship? And if so, are you able to articulate that?
Of course, that there is a certain impact. Then, the kind of work that I do, I study memory. Then, in many ways, what I do is to understand how, in the present, people they engage with the past. Then, of course, that if you look at the issue of slavery through this lens, many of these debates that we have about what happened, what really happened, then during the period of the Atlantic slave trade, during the period of slavery, the fact that this past remained pretty much invisible to us in the public space for a very long time, that we would go to a plantation in the South or to a plantation in Virginia or to New York, and we would not see anything related to slavery, then this new visibility of slavery is the product of people who are alive today and who are pushing to make these realities visible because of the racial inequalities, racism, and the persistency of white supremacy. Then, of course, that there is an impact. People who are visiting the sites, they are leaving people, and they are demanding that this past to be recognized. Very often, then, these demands, these claims, is not something about the past, is not something about what is in the books, but is about the present legacies. Then, In other words, then we can look at this auditorium here and ask ourselves how many black people we have today attending this discussion. We can ask the same question when you are referring to the audiences who go visit Mount Vernon or Monticello then in Virginia. And there are reasons for that. And when some of these individuals, either women, either black men and women who go to these places and they don't see their history, their past recognized and discussed in these sites, that the tendency is that they will start asking to have that recognition, then all this new discussion about the past is then derived from the disclaims from the present. And then I think that we cannot escape that. Then if you see even the discussion about 1619, we saw this in social media, then many people reacting against the emphasis on 1619, some for the good reasons that perhaps we had slavery and people of African descent and enslaved Africans in the continent already 100 years before that, and others saying that indeed slavery was not as important, and that what people are bringing with the discussion of 1619 is then should be rejected because slavery was not as crucial to the development of this nation as these individuals are claiming. Then here we have a debate that we use the past, we use the past events, and we use the slave past in order to fight this battles of the present. And I think that we cannot escape to that. We can participate, we can intervene, we can also question, we can watch, we can see how these discussions perhaps can lead us to give one further step. But I think that this is a problem that, depending on the period, we cannot escape to that. And this, just to conclude, I don't think that is something that is specific to the United States. We have similar debates going on in England, in France, in Brazil, in Latin American countries, including places such as Mexico that perhaps you don't even know that is a place where slavery existed and where there are people of African descent.
And just real briefly, before we get to more questions, one debate that we are having is about reparations. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I know you've done some work on very, very briefly, so I want to get to more questions. But this question of reparations is not a new one. I think that's an important revision for your scholarship as well. There have been people discussing this since the, you know, early, what, 17th century?
18th century, at least that we know. Of course, that if there are new historians doing this kind of work, we can arrive at the conclusion that there were people perhaps demanding reparations earlier. But in this country, then, during the period of the American Revolution, we had individuals, then we don't have a collective movement, but we have individuals who were demanding reparations, and enslaved people who were very aware of the fact that they provided work that contributed to the wealth of their masters and so on. Then these demands occurred here already in the 18th century during the period of the American Revolutionary War. We had that during the 19th century and across the Americas, in the Caribbean, in Brazil and so on. We also had people making those demands. And then, of course, after the end of the Civil War and during end of Reconstruction as well, we are going to see more collective movements demanding reparations. Then all this discussion about reparations, indeed, it's coming back now. And it comes back, I would say, from times to times. But it has been there for very long.
I think one of the powers of history is to show us that things that appear to be revisions or appear to be new are actually extensions or continuations of debates that have been long ongoing. Let's get to some more audience comments and questions. There's a gentleman right there, James, with a question.
Yes, hi. This is a great evening, by the way. Thank you. This is for Dr. Mead. We've been to the American Revolutionary Museum. It's a wonderful place. If no one's been there, you should all go. But following up on your comment about democracy, I would interesting that what that our country has endured for 200 and some years, which is slavery, Civil War, Great Depression, two world wars, et cetera. So you mentioned about democracy, and how confident would you say, or it gets to the panel, will democracy, will our democracy survive?
Ooh. Well, the typical kick the can move of a historian in that question is historians are bad at predictions. We're better at looking backward. There's two sayings, there's nothing new under the sun and you can't step into the same river twice. And both are true, both mean the opposite thing. Every historical dynamic is so different that it's difficult to scientifically model what outcomes could come from a given moment based on understanding the past. It's the limitation of the old saying that those who don't learn the past are doomed to repeat it. Henry Ford famously responded to that concept, saying history is bunk. If it was true that it was of any benefit, we would have basically prevented World War I. And there is a challenge to that. But I think that there are some key dynamics that have been in effect constitutionally since the beginning of the federal government of the United States anyway, chief of which I would think of is the separation of powers. And as different branches of government rise into prominence and power, they tend to meet credibility challenges with the American people, and then other branches rise to seize some power in that gap. And I think there's been a rise in presidential power in the past few decades. I think the question is whether there's the separation of powers is going to operate the way it has in the past. And I think the other question is whether the culture of aspiring to these inclusive egalitarian messages at the core of the American founding documents is healthy. And I think conversations like this one, rooms filled like this one, are some evidence for hope that is true.
And we also have, in addition to historians, educators and professors on this stage. And I wonder, maybe if you want to punt on the historian angle, maybe as educators and professors, seeing the students who come through year after year, I mean, that must offer some hope, I imagine.
Just three brief points on this question of will democracy last. First point, as a historian, we understand that democracy is a process. It's not an event, it's a process. That's the historical lesson that we learn. The second point is that as a process, it's always evolving and always different. So just look around the world at the different models for democratic participation, some of which are in places that you would never imagine them to exist. That's part of the historical element, though. The third point, and I think the most important point that we learned historically, is that one cannot have democracy without struggling for it. The basic example of that was today, when a young woman from Scandinavia addressed a global body and said that the fundamental thing that had to happen in order to bring about change, and change that was egalitarian throughout the world, was for people to become activists. That's the democratic model. So my only fear about democracy is that the people who can really bring it about will be sitting on their duffs watching things go by. So
I would have just said yes. So I've got kids, and my kids worry about the climate. They don't worry about democracy. They worry about the climate. I have an 18-year-old who is a very wise boy. And he said, we haven't even had democracy yet, actually. And that's actually true. When you think about the brief period in which we have experienced a full voter franchise in this country, there are kind of glimpses. We're still grabbing for it, right? So, so I don't think it's the case that we think we're losing democracy. I think we are better equipped by a history of struggling for it to continue to struggle for it. And I know my kids will, and I know my students will. So I say yes.
All right, let's keep moving across the room. We got these two sections thus far. I'm going to jump over to this section back here, and then we'll come back to the middle. But there's someone in the back row with glasses who I can't quite make out, but James, if you can get over there. Hi there. Thank you. Hard to see all the way over here.
My name's Roberta Torian. This has been a great discussion. Hi, John. My question has to do with museums. So the Museum of the American Revolution is remarkable. You walk in the door and you immediately see how inclusive it is, in addition to how creative a lot of the exhibits are and so on. My question is whether, as someone who helped design and run a museum, do you see in the museum community in the United States a movement to make more of them inclusive in this way? Because I think it's Anna who talked about the importance of people seeing themselves if they go to Monticello or their history. My view is that it's more important for people to see other people's history. I've learned my history about my race and my ancestors. It's important for other people who are not related to me to see those contributions. And so do you see that kind of a movement towards more inclusiveness in other museums in the United States?
I think that's beautifully put. And I do. I think one key word that's often repeated in conversations across museums among museum professionals is empathy, that the project of museums is to build just that kind of empathy for people who are different from yourself or might appear to be in some way. And in some cases, that's just because they lived a long time ago. but I think that is that empathy is a muscle. And I think a lot of museums are seeking to be a good gymnasium for that muscle.
We have a few more minutes left, so we'll take a few more questions. A woman's been very patient in the middle there with the glasses. So James, if you're able to pass the microphone, raise your hand again so James can find you. There you go. Yeah.
Thank you. I was the foundational director of the Quaker Information Center in Philadelphia from 1990 to 2003 or so. And it was my pleasure and my honor to try to explain Quakerism past, present, and future to people who called or wrote to the center. One of the hardest questions to answer had to do with William Penn, whom I thought was such a hero and felt to this day is, in so many ways. How could we justify that he had slaves? So I thought about this a lot. I didn't come up with great answers all the time about this. It seems to me that in order to understand anyone's prognostications about what is right and what is appropriate behavior, we have to identify in that era what is the common belief, the worldview, the Weltanschauung, that everyone agrees is common knowledge. For instance, that maybe that children, of course, can't be expected to be as intellectually or otherwise as turned on and engaged as adults, or women are not capable of strong, heavy thought, difficult decision-making, or that Negroes or Blacks or the other is not capable. If there is an era where that is the common belief, that every newspaper you would pick up would reinforce it, every conversation you'd have with a friend or relative or an authority figure, person would reinforce your belief that the other was not capable
of being responsible. And I think what I hear in your question and comment is this sort of understanding people in their own times on their own terms. And I think that's a historiographical challenge, I think. I'll turn to our resident Philadelphia, Pennsylvania scholar and expert.
Yeah, I spent a long time looking at Quakers who enslaved people. You know, so, but let me go to the bigger question you're asking, because there's a lot to be said, actually, about the deep roots of the slave trade in the Quaker community and among the most, some of the most prominent Quaker families in Philadelphia, of course, and, you know, very prominent politicians of the time, the Lloyds and the Norrises and so on. But I think the bigger question you're asking is, can we evaluate people outside their own frame of evaluation? And I think the answer is, first of all, yes, because we are living here and they were living there. And secondly, so it's, you know, history doesn't always ask you to make a moral judgment, but sometimes it really does. And the second thing is that when you say the kind of, when everybody thought, it's not everybody, you know, it might be the people in their kind of small community, or what we would call today a kind of information bubble that views that, but even just the point about, and I realize when you invoke Penn, you're talking about a very particular late 17th century moment, and I'm about to vault us 50 years ahead to the mid-18th century. But, you know, Quaker, there are a lot of very active, very intellectual, politicized Quaker women by the middle of the 18th century who are doing extraordinary things and being recognized for that and recognized within their own communities for their intellectual contributions. And there are certainly people within that community, in the Quaker community. So, I mean, enslaved people are always having a moral position on slavery, right? But there are also people in the Quaker community, the free Quaker community, who have a position on slavery by the mid-18th century that say this is completely contrary and, you know, and anyway, so you're kind of asking a couple different things. One is about how do we understand the information bubble or even the moral bubble that people are living in, and can we evaluate them outside of it? And I would say that that bubble is really a bubble and there are people around it in their own times. But then really, we do get to actually make assessments, you know? That is, they are there and we are here. And we can say, according to the standards of our time, that's just completely, that's just, it's just wrong. I mean, we can, one last thing, which is that I also think it's not the case that we can look at a historical figure like Penn and say there's nothing that he has to contribute to our present day because he was an enslaver. I think the same is true of Jefferson, and I think the same is true of some of the great civil rights leaders of the late 20th century who were misogynists. You know, do they have nothing to contribute to us? That's not the case. I think we have to understand that people are really complex. And there is an unbelievably rare person who contributes unfiltered good to us, you know, out of the past.
I'm conscious of time. We were called for 8:30, but we started a little bit late, so I'm letting us go a little bit late. We can take two more brief questions, and then we will wrap up. But we are offering today a free dessert. So if you stick around to the end, you can get a brownie and a cup of tea, as well as continue to engage with the panelists. So this is not your only chance to be part of the conversation, but we're going to take two more. We'll take one from our student friend in the back, and you'll get the last question. So, James, why don't we get our student in the back to ask a question briefly, and then we'll take this last question here, and then we'll wrap up.
Hello, I'm a current grad student here, and my question is, is it possible for a historian when studying the past to transcend their own time? And is it, and do we even want that? And this is all the panelists or anyone who wants to answer it.
And this is a graduate student, so your question will have implications for this future career. Yeah. Is it possible to transcend our own bubbles, our own time, our own contemporaneousness, so, when we're exploring history? Yeah.
So there are two conflicting views on that, all right? So the first one comes from a historiographer that I guess I worship, William Appleman Williams, who makes a distinction between reading history, writing history, and doing history. The act of doing history is the attempt to immerse oneself in the historical moment out of which one writes. The conflicting view, though, is a view by Stuart Hall, who argues that there is a serious impossibility of disengaging oneself from the space from which one writes. So there's a contention there for any intellectual in terms of doing this kind of work. This is the kind of work, though, that that some people argue or will ask about questions of objectivity. The rational person will look for balance. And the balance is between the moment in which we exist and the purpose of our history and the moments that we're attempting to historicize and what they tell us about our own existence.
Yeah, I think that's beautifully put. You know, I think when we talk about revisionist history, people sometimes think that historians are distorting the past. And, you know, we don't exactly have a Hippocratic Oath, but we might as well. And one of those is we don't distort the past. You know, you don't take things out of context and frame them absolutely, you know, in some completely other context. That's wrong. That's illegitimate practice. And we see this happen all the time. I mean, when Anna and I see each other on social media, sometimes it's because some person is tweeting about some piece of information they've found and they read and they believe that that contradicts a whole, you know, line of argument and a whole set of evidence. And that's just not something we would ever do. As professional historians, you're committed to not distorting. But you can. I think, you know, I could never be put this as eloquently as you did, but I don't think you can live outside your own time. I don't think we can unsee things, unfeel them, and unbelieve them.
I think it's also true that deeply engaging in the past, though, gives you a kind of almost a perspective layered so thoroughly sometimes in that past as to shape your present, maybe more than your present is shaping, or as much as your present is shaping your interpretation of the past. I remember a friend of mine in graduate school being accused of interpreting Charles I, who's the subject of his dissertation, through the lens of George W. Bush, and he said, "I know nothing about George W. Bush. If anything, I interpret the whole world as Charles I." So I think it is a dialectic.
Final question from our friend right here.
Well, you were calling for the educators. Here's one. Retired, of course, look at my hair. Retired from active teaching, but not retired from active living history, like you just said, Dr. Kay, thank you. A couple of things that really called my attention very deeply. One, somehow the panel tried to dissociate the concept of climate change or climate in general with democracy, with the idea of democracy. Just one, as a science teacher and as a person living in this world, I would like to set the record straight.
Okay, but you must do it
climate.
Briefly. Please, briefly, yeah. Very because briefly. We are keeping people from dessert.
Oh, are we? I hope I'm not. Well, climate is the most democratic idea you can imagine because it will affect us all equally. Not because you have more money, because you have in the East or in the West, up or down. Climate is for us all to absorb. That's number one, so I hope that I clarified that notion. Second thing is that I had the chance and the opportunity of working in two different schools, public school teacher. One was predominantly black, African-American. That was for 7 years. And then 26 plus years in a predominantly Jewish, Irish, and all those, another social group. And I came to live personally very deeply disturbing idea of even the textbooks, where you were exploring the idea, this notion of racism. And how could I came from another country, but then I came to live personally that living idea of racism, even the history texts, the lectures that they gave. I mean, all the, I can submit to you that I saw that so deeply that I became, you know, just enraged.
Sure.
Coming from another part of the world. So this is the question. How any of you envision the idea of racism? Make a hypothetical point. How can this be eradicated or somehow, you know, reduced here in America? How would you see that?
Well, if I threw a volleyball earlier, that might be a cannonball. I'm not sure we can address that in the time that we have left. I'll throw it to the panel if they want to offer any brief ideas about how grappling and engaging with this past of early America can be put to use to create a better world in the future, which is, I think, very consonant with the mission of the LePage Center.
Well, I would just say that, you know, when we see a complex and diverse early America, we're more likely to live successfully in a complex and diverse modern world. When I say early America is foundational, that early America that we see as foundational tells us what it is we're building upon. So I don't know about, the work of racism is the work of humanity, you know, but I do think that history has a place.
I think it goes back to the comment before about exercising the muscle of empathy, being able to, in some ways it doesn't matter which history you're studying, or if you're studying another contemporary culture, the practice of recognizing the humanity, rationality, emotional world of someone who differs from you, it can be translated across your life, and I think that is something history really significantly offers.
I think that for all the panelists up here, one of the things that's inherent to the question of being revisionist is the fact that everyone here challenges issues of oppression in different ways, racism being one of them. And so part of it, as an educator, is the continuous education of our students and ourselves to these kinds of things, and the continuous revision of the kinds of symbols and histories that we see before us. So it's ongoing. It's like democracy itself. It's never the same in every era.
And it's a question that we are going to continue to explore throughout the academic year. We have 5 more events coming up, different subjects, different topics, but at the root, I think, some of these very fundamental questions about the past, how it matters to the present, what role it plays in our society and our democracy. So I hope you will join us for those. And I hope for those of you who came in with one idea of what revision and revisionist history might be, perhaps we've complicated that a bit for you. Perhaps we have a little bit more work to do. And if that's the case, please do come back. There's information about our future programs on your way out. There's also a light reception with some brownies and some coffee and some tea, which our panelists will be joining. So if you have other thoughts and questions that you didn't get a chance to ask, please do stick around for that. And please join me in thanking this extraordinary panel for being with us.